welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 5th of December 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's only a few weeks until Christmas, but it's the beginning of the week right now, and it's Monday. That means we are going to be discussing the news of interest to British nationalists, and who better to do that with than Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
I'm personally quite well. I'm just sort of spiritually reeling from the news that we've had this week of the 2021 census and the further decline into multiracialism that our country's taking. And as I think I've said on quite a few occasions, I can remember as a student turning round to my compatriots at the time, my fellow students, and when the subject of immigration came about, and telling them that if current trends continued, then before long, immigrants and people of ethnic minority stock would be running this country. And I have to say that the proportion of people of immigrant and ethnic minority stock within Britain is constantly increasing. The number of indigenous British people seems to have stagnated, and here we are with our government significantly composed of people from ethnic minorities. And so the prediction that I made all that time ago when I was a student has come true. And as each year ticks by, becomes even more blatantly true. Saddens me to that my prediction has come true. I would have loved it to have been anything other than what's happened, but you know, here we are.
It is a great shame, isn't it? But it is, at least I think, waking people up to the situation. As soon as the census results came out last week, Nigel Farage put a video out drawing lots of attention to two facts. The white British are now a minority in the capital city and in two other cities, and also that Christianity is now a minority religion in Britain. And straight away, the BBC tried to counteract this, and they were saying, Nigel's got it wrong. White people aren't a minority. It's only white British people that are a minority in the capital. And of course, everyone, oh, that's okay then, isn't it? It's only white British. If you add all the Europeans, then they're not quite a minority yet in London. But I mean, what a state of affairs to say that white British people are now a minority in their capital city. And also there have been people saying that in the next census they're going to actually remove ethnicity completely. But I've also heard that they're not going to do that. I think the Office of Statistics have come out and said that they're not going to do that. They did bring out a very, very helpful map, which you can use and you can zoom in and you can see exactly what the percentage is for any particular ethnicity that you are interested in. And the one thing you can't do is just have white ethnicity, because I guess they're saying that's not an ethnicity, that's a race. But what they're saying you can look in for is white, English, Welsh, Scottish and Northern Irish, or you can look up Polish, or you can look up specific European ethnicities, but you can't actually just look up all white people together, which has been very interesting to do that. I mean, we still do have some places in the country that are 99.6% white, 99.7% white. Of course, they're right out in the country, right out in the rural areas. In all the cities, they have a considerable amount of non-white ethnicity that are living there. I believe you found one area, Max, that you actually knew of, and that had a very low percentage of white people. What was that one?
And that was one of the parts of Bury Park in Luton, which I think consisted of part of Dunstable Road and Chatsworth Road, where the proportion of white people was down to 4.5%. But then there was also an area in the central part of Leicester that I identified, which was down to just 4.4% white people. And you've only got to drive through those areas to become blatantly aware of the fact that it's almost like you've gone through some kind of a a geography warp or whatever, and come out into a different country. So stark can be the transition from being in what appears to be a fairly sort of average English town to suddenly appearing to be in a street that wouldn't look out of place in the centre of Delhi, for example.
It's been a very rapid change as well, you know, the whole country, or England and Wales rather, are now only 75% white British. And I think it was 10 years ago, it was like 87%. 10 years before that, it was 90 something. So it's literally just in the last 20 years, it's been doubling. And it's gone from like 95% white to 75% white just in about 20 years. And also, I think 1/6 of the population are foreign born. And that means that they have traveled here within the last 10, 20 years, not even second generation or anything like that. And then when you look at the makeup of the children in the schools, you'll see that the youngest group that are actually in the schools, whites, I think they only make up about 50%, and the non-whites make up 50%. So by the time they get to being adults, and in that generation, white people are going to be a minority amongst their generation very, very soon. And this is all happening so fast. And it is good that Nigel Farage has drawn attention to this, and he's always sort of shied away from ethno-nationalism before, but he's now saying that nobody voted for this. Nobody gave their consent for this. This was all just forced upon the British people without any debate, without any conversation about it. Anybody that points out the negative side of it, of course, gets accused of being a racist and just hating the colour of the skin, rather than the fact of the matter, which is that obviously these people that are saying this, they love their own group. They love their own family. And they love their own extended family. There's nothing wrong with loving your extended family. It doesn't mean that you hate all the world's other extended families. And you certainly can't blame people for wanting to come to white countries, especially if they come from countries which are underdeveloped, don't have such a high standard of living. Of course, they're going to want to come to a country which does have a higher standard of living. So you know, the fault for this lies with our elected representatives. They're the ones that have this policy, this open borders policy, effectively, which is allowing all these people to just flood into the country, regardless of what the populace actually have to say about it. And of course, the Conservative Party have promised that they were going to get immigration down at every one of the last elections, and they've completely failed to do that. Another side of this, which people are also talking about, is this fact that Christianity is now a minority religion in the country. And of course, a lot of people are saying, well there's more Muslims, the Muslims are increasing, that's what it is. And it's not really that. I think Muslims have increased by 25%, but they're still under 10% Muslims. I think what the issue is, because they're saying that the biggest increase has been in people that have no religion at all. The biggest increase has been in atheists. So they're saying, so this cannot be the fault of immigration. But it is the fault of immigration, because if you have a Christian country and you say Christianity is the one true religion, and you then invite in Muslims and you say, well, Muslims are a true religion as well, that's true as well. Well, that can't be true, can it? You know, you can't have both of them telling the truth. Either one is telling the truth, or the other is telling the truth, or none of them are telling the truth. And I think that's what we're now seeing. We're seeing this great rise in atheists, because they're saying, well, all these religions can't all be true. We've got them all in our country. We're told that we have to honor each of them, but they can't all be true. So yes, immigration has caused this increase in atheists, simply because you have all these different religions here now. And instead of what we were told before, which was that Christianity was correct and these other religions were wrong, they were false religions, and as a Christian, you should seek to convert these people, we're not told that anymore. We're told that they're all truthful, which of course can't be true. So I think that's the reason for this rise in atheism. Any thoughts on that, Max?
Well, what I'd say is that part of the problem with Christianity is that it is a religion that that most of Europe inherited from the Middle East. It is a religion that I think that Europe has benefited from, in spite of the fact that we've adopted Christianity. I think that Christianity is a feeble religion, and it's a religion which, in the modern age, welcomes the replacement of our own people by people from around the rest of the world. Christianity, you find outside most churches nowadays, there'll be signs welcoming immigrants to the country. And the result of this is that any indigenous white people that have got any brains at all, they just realize that what they're being told by their clergyman, the clergyman in their local church, is nonsense. And so they stop going to church. They still treasure the churches, and you know, from my own perspective, when I go to towns, I very often will go and seek out a church, and I'll greatly appreciate the solace and the sort of quiet and peacefulness that you can appreciate by going and sitting in a church. It's a great place to go and contemplate things. But I then totally detest what the Church of England has become over the years. And I can remember as a boy liking some clergymen that I encountered. I would perhaps go to a church for some specific reason. It might, you know, just have been a wedding or something of that sort. But the clergyman that took the service would have been what I would describe as a traditional fire and brimstone kind of clergyman, who was the sort of person who projected a morality which he held in spite of the fact that he adhered to Christianity, not because of it, because what he adhered, the sort of qualities that make me call him a fire and brimstone kind of preacher is the passion that any normal person would have for the well-being of the people that they look after, the well-being of their flock. But what's happened is, over the decades, is that clergymen have tended to become younger, trendier, woke, drawn from sexual minorities, and they've adopted an entirely unhealthy approach to life, and they try and convey that unhealthy approach to life to their flock. And of course, when they do that, because part of what they say is that we must make space for people from foreign countries to come and live in our country, and we mustn't object to these people coming and living in our country. And, oh, by the way, have you noticed that it's the burgeoning population of the world that is causing all the problems that that the world is encountering at the moment, in terms of there being a lack of food, in terms of there being overcrowding, in terms of the fact that the sewage systems in all the developed parts of the world are becoming overwhelmed, because the health services and things in third world countries isn't sufficient to cope with the burgeoning numbers of people that they have, and by the way, members of my flock, you know, you can help to correct this by not having as many children as you might have done otherwise. You know, these are the kind of notions and ideas that are being projected by vicars today. And of course, I mean, it's only within the last couple of days, in response to the census statistics, that I saw an interview of a clergyman who said that when this church, which is the church at which he preaches, was first built, there was a congregation of 700 people that used to come every weekend, he said, and now we perhaps get 10 to 20 people that turn up, and some of those will be children who, you know, I would imagine probably aren't that interested, but just go along because their parents drag them along. And so it's a situation where the size of that church's congregation is reduced to a 35th of what it was when the church was first built, which is shocking.
Yeah, I certainly agree there that the church has become weak and feeble, and it's certainly setting a bad example. But then if you look back centuries ago, we went on the Crusades, you know, and they certainly weren't saying we welcome Muslims into our country. They were saying, well, we need to get the Muslims out of the Holy Land. And we had before that, you know, you had Charles Martel presenting the Saracens from making their way into Europe, and there was a big pushback against this that was organised by the church. And you compare that to today, and of course you've got the head of the Church of England welcoming more immigration, saying there should be more immigration. And the only vicar that I can think of that's actually speaking up against this is actually black. You got Calvin Robertson, who this week has been posting images of Enoch Powell saying we should have paid attention to Enoch Powell and something needs to be done about this, and the English are being replaced at a rate of knots and Christianity is disappearing. And of course he can get away with saying that because he's black, basically. He identifies as being English because he is one of his parents was English. I think another of his parents is Jamaican, and he appears to be the only clergy that I can think of that's actually drawing attention to this, which again, I mean, it should really shame white people and shame all the rest of the clergy that we have to have somebody that is black who identifies as English that is pointing this out instead of somebody whose ancestry is English. It's a great shame that they have just become weak and feeble, and it's like they're just destroying their own church, basically. And so I think, yeah, you're right there, Max. I think that plays into this, and the fact that the church is not sticking to its traditions of being against homosexuality, being against miscegenation, being against divorce, being against abortion, all of these things. The church is just takes a step back nowadays, and the leaders of the church seem to promote these ideas in some instances, you know, gay marriage and transgender appreciation ceremonies or whatever it is they have now. I mean, it's crazy. And there are people, parents, that are actually pulling their children out of the schools because of the transgenderism that's now being taught in Anglican schools. So Nigel Farage was pointing this out. As I say, he was pointing out the replacement of the white British at a rate of knots, and he was also pointing out the replacement of Christianity as a majority religion. It's now the minority religion. And he was also pointing out what's really been going on with this scandal that's been happening in Buckingham Palace. And what happened was there was a charity dinner that was given for charities that deal with the victims of domestic violence. And I believe the Queen Consort, I think, is that the correct name for her? Camilla Parker Bowles. She was there. Yeah, she was there. And there was a lady in waiting there. I believe her name was Lady Susan Hussey, who had given 60 years service, I think, as a lady in waiting to the late Queen. And she was talking to somebody there who was obviously trying to draw attention to the fact that her heritage was from Africa. She was wearing a leopard print dress. I think she had earrings that were shaped like Africa. She had great dreadlocks. And this lady, Susan Hussey, was saying, where are you from? Obviously meaning, where is your ancestry from? What part of Africa are you from? Professor Edward Dutton has pointed out that it's quite obvious that her ancestry is Bantu. She was a Bantu. She should have said, my ancestry is a Bantu, and I moved here with my parents came here on the Windrush, and I've been brought up here. But my ethnicity is obviously African or Bantu. But instead of saying that, she refused to answer and got funny about it and was saying, I'm British. But of course, she's not of British ethnicity. That's what's being asked. What's when somebody says, where are you from, like that, the context of it really means, where are your family from? What is your extended family? What is the group that you are a part of, is what they're saying. They're not saying, where are you born? I mean, it doesn't matter so much where you're born. If you're born in a barn, it doesn't make you a horse. It still makes you a human being. And I think that's what people are asking. And because of this, because this lady in waiting asked her where she was from, there's been a huge scandal about this. She's been accused of being racist. And this woman, black African ethnicity woman, Ngozi Fulani, she calls herself, she runs a charity which is called Sister Space. And the charity itself is specifically for black and Caribbean ethnicity. So it's specifically for African ethnicity, I think it actually says. So she runs a charity that is specifically for this ethnicity. And yet when she gets asked, you know, what is your ethnicity? Who is it you're campaigning for? She gets all upset about it and offended and says how terrible it is and how racist it is. And this, and she, the name she has, this Ngozi Fulani, even that is, appropriated from somewhere else. Her real name is Marlene Headley. So she's taking this African name to pretend that she's African, and then she gets all insulted when she's effectively asked, what part of Africa is it? Is it that you come from? And this poor lady, Susan Hussey, I mean, she must be absolutely mortified at this. Her job as lady-in-waiting is to go around these people at this party, find out the details of who they are, where they're from, what they're doing, and then report that back to the Queen Consort, and to point out the most important ones for the Queen Consort to speak to, so that when she speaks to them, she has some background information. You know, this lady-in-waiting was doing what she should have been doing, what she's been doing for 60 years, and she's now been called a racist. The royals have disowned her, basically, and she's the godmother, I think, to Prince William, the Prince of Wales, and they've all just thrown her under the bus, and I just feel so sorry for this woman. She's given 60 years of her life as a lady-in-waiting. I don't think she gets paid for that either. I think it's a voluntary thing that you do. It's incredible the way she's been thrown under the bus. And this Ngozi Fulani, she's been doing all these interviews. She's the centre of attention. She's been on all the news programmes talking about how absolutely awful it is that she was asked where she was from, after, you know, deliberately making it so that she as if she wanted people to ask her that question. And she also went into this party with a recorder, and she recorded this. So obviously she went there armed with a recording device, hoping that something like this would happen. Apparently she's accused the royals of carrying out domestic violence against Meghan. And what she means by domestic violence is racism, because racisms are now the equivalent of violence. So she was saying that because somebody said something that Meghan didn't like, that was actually domestic violence. She's actually said this in a tweet. And I saw a tweet from somebody else yesterday, a lady who had actually gone to this sister space for help with domestic violence. And she was turned away because she wasn't black. She wasn't the right colour in order to do this. So it's absolutely scandalous. And I think the whole country, or at least the white British portion of the country, I think will be entirely behind Lady Susan Hussey. I think there is a petition to have her reinstated. And I just feel so sorry for the woman. I mean, she must be absolutely mortified. This is the worst thing that could ever possibly happen to this poor lady. And she was just doing her job, and she was just being friendly, and she was just trying to inquire about something which the woman she was talking to obviously wanted to have inquired about. Otherwise she wouldn't have looked like that. She wouldn't have been wearing, you know, traditional African dress. She wouldn't have given herself an African name instead of an English name. The charity that she worked for wouldn't have been specifically for, I think it's African and Caribbeans, you know, specifically the ethnicity. So she was doing what she should have been doing. And of course the BBC and all the mainstream media have been talking about this with great glee about what this horrible racist at the palace has done, and that it's only right that she should be sacked, and why hasn't a representative of the palace spoken to this poor Ngozi Fulani, who is so damaged by the explicit racism of this lady-in-waiting just asking where she's from. I mean, it just really highlights the failure of multiculturalism, doesn't it? I'm sure you must have seen this, Max. This is the main news, isn't it, that somebody black was asked where they were from. What do you think of it?
Yeah, that's right. I did notice that, and I've done a little bit of sort of research into this, not very extensive, but a bit of research, and it comes up with sort of the information you find is that that Miss Fulani, I think you've said that her first name was Marlene. I'm not aware of what her first name was, but I imagine it probably was an English name, because her surname at birth was Headley, because her mother was called Mildred and her father was called Gladstone Headley. And so she would have originally been born with an English name, and she's adopted an African name. And the research that I did tells me that Ngozi, I think, is a Nigerian name, and that Fulani is the name of a Nigerian tribe. And so she's chosen to be sort of named after the tribe and to adopt a Nigerian name. And it appears that the first thing that struck me when I saw this on television and saw pictures of Ngozi Fulani was that she appeared to be, to me, in African national dress. And yeah, you know, because her clothing was very stylized mimicking the style of clothing that's worn by women across vast swathes of Africa. And so it's the most obvious thing that somebody would assume in meeting somebody if they appear to be African in appearance and they appear to be in something approximating African national dress, then it's only reasonable that you would assume they probably are from Africa. And then you might start off with a question such as, where do you come from? In the same way that if Susan Hussey had encountered a man dressed in a tartan kilt with a sporran and a set of bagpipes under his arm and a tam o' shanter on his head, probably would have made the assumption the chap was from Scotland and might have said to him, what part of Scotland are you from? And that wouldn't have been a rude inquiry. That would have just been the kind of natural assumption that anybody would make that doesn't, you know, it doesn't convey racism, you know, whatsoever. It conveys an interest in finding out about the person and why they've attended this function dressed in the unusual way that they were dressed. And so this is an enormous fuss over nothing. The most shameful part of the whole thing, though, is the fact that the royal family and the royal household haven't refused to accept Susan Hussey's resignation, and that nobody from the royal household had the courage to sort of come forward and just defend what she was doing and say, look, she was only doing her job, and she had no intention of being racist. She was just making small talk in such a way as to, as you say, gather information about the people who had attended the function so that that information could be fed back and so that it could be used in order to foster good relations between all the people that had attended the meeting. And it's just a shame that Ms. Fulani decided to react negatively to what Susan Hussey was saying and wasn't forthcoming. And then that this whole issue has been blown up subsequently and made into a kind of a scandal or whatever when nothing of the sort needed to happen.
Yeah, I mean, it was an international get together, so you are going to have people from elsewhere. And she's also said that she was wearing a name tag. Everybody there had a name tag, and her name tag was obscured by her dreadlocks. And the lady in waiting, she lifted up her dreadlocks to see her name tag. Well, why wouldn't you display your name tag so that people could actually see it? Why hide it under the dreadlocks? And of course, on the name tag, it says Ngozi Fulani, an African name. So she's saying, I have an African name, I'm dressed in African dress, please ask me about Africa, basically. And yet when she does, she gets all offended about this and says that she's from, you know, she's from Hackney. And again, this highlights this problem that there is with telling people that their ethnicity is the same as their citizenship. I mean, because she was saying, I felt as if like I'd lost my nationality. Because that was it. The lady in waiting was also asking her about what her nationality was. And of course, what she means by that is nation, natal, birth, extended family. What is the family that you are from? Yes, we understand that you are a British citizen, but what is the extended family that you were from? And that's what the word means. But of course, we now have this confusion because we're telling people that they're British when in actual fact they're a British citizenship, but they're not of British ethnicity. I mean, to be a British ethnicity, you have to have shared ancestry with the Britons. And the word itself, British, means to look like Brutus, who was a Trojan prince. He wasn't an African prince. He was a Trojan prince. The word British itself means to look like that. So it effectively means to look white. You know, the earliest name that we had for Britain, Albion, what does that word mean? Well, again, that comes from the word Alba, which means white. So these words that are used for ethnicity, they're based on the specifics of what somebody looks like. It's actually there in the word itself. So when somebody asks about that and they ask where you're from, they're asking you what family are you from, or where is it that your family is from? And when they talk about nationality, I think most of the time they're referring to your ethnicity, not your citizenship. And I think they still do this in Russia. They'll say somebody is a citizen of Russia, but their nationality may not be Russian. And that's the way that it is elsewhere in the world. I mean, if you were, say you were living in China and you got asked where you were from, you know, you wouldn't expect to say, oh, I'm from China. You would say, well, I'm an Englishman that lives in China. And you wouldn't think that anybody was being rude in asking you that. And this idea that it's rude to ask somebody where they're from, it's really just showing an interest and trying to be friendly. It's almost as if they're saying, well, you know, people are going to be too frightened to talk to non-whites because they're going to be accused of racism if they ask them any of these questions about them that they obviously want to be asked, or they wouldn't be so flamboyant about it. They wouldn't be, I mean, she was literally advertising the fact that her ethnicity was from Africa, and then got all upset and accused the person of racism when they were sort of asking them questions, expecting them to be wanting to say, my ancestry is from Africa, my ancestry is from this particular part of Africa, Nigeria, as you were saying there, Max, which would tie in with her ancestry being Bantu. I mean, it's obvious that her ancestry is Bantu. Her ancestry isn't in any of the British nations, Welsh, English, or Northern Irish, or Scottish. It's Bantu. It's Nigerian. And to signal that, she changed her name. It's scandalous, absolutely scandalous.
But can you imagine what would have been the situation had Susan Hussey thought to herself, here's a lady who is dressed in a very particular style, which could indicate or could not indicate her ethnicity, rather than risk making a mistake and asking the woman a question that she might take exception to, even though it was intended harmlessly, what I'll do is I'll pass her by and I'll go and speak to some of the other people that have attended the function. Now, had Susan Hussey done that, then a complaint wouldn't have been made about the fact that she'd asked questions, but a complaint could then still have been made about the fact that she was racist because she didn't actually try to engage in conversation the woman who was dressed in a style reminiscent of African national dress. And so poor Susan Hussey was damned if she did, and she was damned if she didn't. And that's the real injustice here. And the fact that nobody in authority has stood up for her and for her corner and said, no, she didn't do anything wrong. We're sorry that Ngozi Filani was offended, but it sort of appears that she gets offended about lots of things, and Susan Hussey hasn't done anything wrong.
Yeah, good point. I mean, that's it, basically. And I do think some people have drawn attention to it. Nigel Farage has. I think there's been some commentary in the Daily Mail and on GB News. And I think generally, you know, the ethnic British of the country are supportive of her.
It would be nice if her godson had actually said something in support of her, wouldn't it?
Definitely.
Which you might imagine he probably would have done if he was sufficiently courageous.
Yeah, that's just it. They should have stood up for her, and we all feel very, very sorry for her for the way that she's been treated. Well, we finished with our British eugenics presentation in the last episode, and we have another presentation on eugenics to get into this week, but it's not specifically British. It's talking about Greek and Roman eugenics, and particularly about the euthanasia side of it. Obviously, something which is going to cause quite a bit of discussion about, I think, you know, the positive nature of it, the negative nature of it. And it's a terrible thing to see what's happening at the moment with some of these countries like Canada and Switzerland, which are just making it easier and easier for people to kill themselves. They even have this pod now, a portable pod, which is basically a portable gas chamber. And if people want to off themselves, they can just go into this chamber, which is an absolutely terrible state of affairs. And euthanasia does form a part of eugenics. So it is a discussion that we are going to have to have. Obviously, we condemn the idea of the state effectively executing people. But if you're not going to have that, then there needs to be some other ways of preventing negative genetics making their way into the general population. And of course, today we have genetic screening, which we can use. We can also see the fetus when somebody is pregnant. We can see whether they're going to be disabled or not. So before somebody is actually born, we can prevent that from happening and prevent that from making its way into the general population. But years ago, they weren't able to do that. So what we have today, we have a presentation on ancient eugenics and the euthanasia side of it. And this actually comes from a Substack called Forbidden Knowledge, where they say, reviewing and commenting on the forbidden literature of philosophers, the misunderstood texts of societies, and the forgotten tales of our past. And they begin by saying, as a people, a family, a clan, a tribe, or even a nation, the health of the group depends on individual choices, both in who the individuals choose to procreate with and who the individuals choose to bar from procreation, or in the extreme, kill entirely. These choices that lead to either a replication of healthy genes or the improvement of the overall genetics of a people are called eugenics. Ultimately, what the law permits and what the society encourages is what will decide the outcome of the health of their own people. To understand eugenics, one must ground themselves in the understanding of its etymology. Eugenics can be broken down into two roots, EU meaning good and genics meaning origin or birth. So quite literally, it means good origin or good birth. And we've covered this before, I know. We're just going over it again for a second time. Eugenics involves every decision around the promotion. That's every decision around the promotion of procreation of healthy members of the society and the demotion of procreation of the unhealthy members of the society. How these eugenic practices are carried out has changed over time and from civilization to civilization, but the outcome is fundamentally the same. And we've mainly talked about the positive eugenics before. And now this is the negative eugenics, euthanasia. If eugenics thus means of good origin, what does the term euthanasia mean? Euthanasia can also be broken down into two roots, EU, which again means good, and thanatos, or death. So euthanasia means good death, but what does a good death mean? What did it mean to the Greeks and the Romans? To the Greco-Romans, a good death would have been considered something along the lines of a dignified death, one without whimpering and cowardice. Today, euthanasia means something along the lines of an easy death, one without pain or suffering. The meaning has slightly shifted, and this is a reflection of the societies that keep their meaning alive. A different view of euthanasia could be that the death was for the good of the health of the society. But how could a death be good? One could view a people as a living organism and each person as an individual cell. When a healthy body has sick cells, it sends its antibodies to kill the sickly cells for the good of the healthy cells. Another analogy could be a gardener represented by the hand of the society. When a gardener recognizes a sickly leaf infected with parasites, fungus, or a disease, he will choose to shear off the infected leaf or forsake the plant entirely to otherwise save his garden. So this is something that went on in the past that doesn't go on today. And obviously we have a considerable number of weak and sickly people that are living today as a result of the advance of medical technology. And in the past, something was done about this, which we will get into, but that's not being done today. So I would suggest that there has to be found something else, another mechanism that can be used to prevent the introduction of weak genetics into the general population. As I said there at the beginning, I think genetic screening would help with that, and also encouraging the people that do have weak genetics not to breed, rather than what went on in the past, which, as we'll get into, which is when somebody was born and they were deformed or they were sickly, then they were exposed to the elements, basically. Obviously not something anybody would want to have to do, but they did have to do this in the past. Otherwise, the nation could end up being filled with weak and sickly people, and they could end up being taken over by another nation. So, you know, it was just a very uncomfortable fact of life, basically. I think that will do for the introduction here. Max, what are your views on this?
We have kind of touched on these subjects quite a bit in the past. I think that in times gone by, when science was nowhere near as advanced as it is today, and where surgery was nowhere near as skillful, where obviously there was no knowledge of genetics and no knowledge of genetic genetic engineering or genetic modifications or any sort of kind of gene therapies that that can be available today. And so people took what appear to be more sort of direct and brutal methods in order to cull those sections of the population that they felt would be a drain on their society and would cause their and would therefore be a burden that their society would have to carry, perhaps to its detriment if it was living in a very dangerous time when there was a lot of competition from other warlike peoples that surrounded them. Nowadays, we're in a much better situation, I think, and there isn't any need nowadays because of the science that we've developed over the centuries. There is no need for us to apply what people can regard as being negative eugenic principles or hard eugenics, where there is talk of people being euthanized, or where there's talk of people being sterilized. I don't think anything of that sort needs to be done nowadays, and it wouldn't be very popular if you were going to be advocating it. What needs to be done, though, is that there just needs to be, within the general education system, the morality of eugenics needs to be taught so that children grow up realizing that there is a need for us to promote those elements within our population that are good and healthy, and to try to reduce those elements within our population that are not healthy and which can disadvantage us as a people. And the things you've mentioned, genetic screening, genetic engineering, and even without those, if you just simply discourage people who have undesirable characteristics, whether they be mental characteristics or physical characteristics, from having as many children, if you encourage them to have children at a rate which is less than the replacement rate, then that will be a beneficial effect and will be eugenic. And if you encourage people who've got the more desirable characteristics to have larger than replacement levels of children, then that would be eugenic from the other direction. And in fact, you could just have a society that applied positive eugenics with regard to just solely encouraging those people with the most desirable physical and mental characteristics to have more children. That in itself would have a eugenic effect, and that in itself would mean each successive generation would be better than the previous generation in all sorts of respects, and it would lead to the uplift of our civilization.
Yeah, and they didn't have those abilities back then to do that society-wide, so they had to use rather brutal methods to achieve the same. And I just also want to point out that, I don't believe there's any need for state-sanctioned euthanasia for people that get old and they think that, you know, that they're in a lot of pain and you know, they should end their lives. There should be no need whatsoever for elderly people to be in pain. You know, if they're in pain, it's because their ability to acquire pain relievers, painkillers, has been restricted. I think there are far too many restrictions on doctors nowadays to actually ease people's pain when they get older. So I think a lot of people, you know, they might get frightened that, you know, when they're old, they might be in a lot of pain and they will be uncomfortable and they might end up wanting to end it all. And that's a terrible state of affairs, and that should never happen, because we do have the ability to get rid of most pain. Doctors have the ability to do that. And I think they should use that a lot more with the elderly. I don't like to see the elderly in pain, but as I say, that's another side to euthanasia. This is what we're mainly talking about today, is the eugenic side of it. Euthanasia cannot be done by the hand of doctors, however, or at least it should not be, for it goes against the Hippocratic oath, which every doctor must take. And of course, doctors nowadays, they go against that Hippocratic oath with abortion, and they also go against that Hippocratic oath with euthanasia. Hippocrates was an ancient Greek physician from Kos, a small island off the coast of Asia Minor. He created an oath, which is a promise and formal declaration made to another person, made in the watchful eye of God. The consequences of breaking an oath has always meant death, usually inflicted by God. And within the Hippocratic Oath, there is a small section which says, I will do no harm or injustice to them, neither will I administer a poison to anybody when asked to do so. There is much to be said about the Hippocratic Oath, but that deserves attention all of its own. For now, it is sufficient that you should know that doctors take an oath against intentionally harming or killing their patients, even when asking for a swift death. This shows that Greek doctors of the ancient world would not administer poisons to their patients to assist in killing them sooner. Greeks, however, did understand the burden placed upon a society by the sick. Now, while a temporary illness was viewed with pity and care, the burden of unfortunate lifelong disease and deformities was viewed in a different way, for they affect a society quite differently. In the wilderness, the permanently afflicted persons would typically die on their own. However, a civilization provides the necessary protection and care for these ill-born to live an unnaturally long life, and the Greeks and the Romans recognized this as a burden. And again, I'll just stop there. I mean, as I say, this Hippocratic Oath, it does seem to me as if a lot of these doctors are ignoring this now. But the point that what he's really making here is that it's not just the fact that somebody who is born deformed is going to have problems looking after themselves. It's that society is going to have to look after them. And in the ancient world, if you got, you know, you don't have such access to resources that we have today. The whole of society has to work to look after the society. And if you've got somebody there that is just a burden, that isn't actually contributing, again, it's going to weaken the society. It's going to make it easier for another group to take them over, I think. So it's basically pointing out the fact that although these people back then, they would look after people that got ill, to allow somebody that was permanently ill from birth to live just meant that was going to be a huge burden on society. And I think really they're just looking at these things practically. I think if an animal in the wild gives birth to an animal that is weak or sickly, then that animal dies off. They allow it to die off. And that in some cases just happens naturally because they're not strong enough to get to the milk, or not strong enough to get there against the other animals that are in the, you know, that are there, that have been born with it. So naturally they would end up dying off. But obviously where we're human beings, we could take steps to ensure that a human being like that could live to adulthood. But if they did live to adulthood, it would mean that a certain portion of society was devoted to just taking care of that person and looking after them. And you couldn't really afford to do that, I don't think. Any thoughts on that, Max?
I think that one of the things you mentioned about was elderly people, and as somebody who's sort of getting towards that end, that life stage myself, I think that there is value in having a good death. And you sort of touched on this a little bit earlier. And I think that if, you know, for whatever reason, whether it be age or whether it be some sort of genetic mishap or whatever in your procreation, in your creation, I should say, in your birth, if somebody finds themselves in a condition where their life has and the quality of life has been reduced to the point where they don't actually want to carry on living, then they should have the option of euthanasia, so that they can end that life. I don't think people should be put in a position where pressure is applied to them to conform with that, or to make a decision one way or the other. I think that care should be taken to make sure that people aren't under duress. But where somebody clearly isn't under duress, and where they have decided that life for them has become unbearable and they don't want to continue it, then they should be able to end it. I think also there are we're talking here about degrees of deformity, etc. There are lots of different shades of grey within this entire question, ranging from somebody who may have just a minor cosmetic problem which can be very easily and quickly put right, all the way through to somebody who would lead a life that nobody in their right mind would want to lead. And so, you know, if it's known that a woman is carrying a child, which when it's born is going to be grossly deformed and disfigured and unable to lead any kind of a normal life, and probably won't even have the ability to make a rational decision themselves. They will lack mental capacity, as the phrase is. If you know that somebody's going to be born in that situation, then parents should have the right to sanction an abortion in order to relieve themselves of that. And I think that would be the right thing to do as well.
Yeah, and also I think that's a choice for, when you were saying there about somebody old and, you know, that they have an illness or whatever and life becomes a great burden to them, then that is the choice for them to make if they want to end their life. I mean, what they're saying here is that doctors should not be doing that because they've taken this oath. If somebody wishes to end their life because they're just suffering too much, that's the responsibility of that person to make. And if they're not in their right mind, then really it's the responsibility of their family to make. But it's not the responsibility of the state, I don't think, and not the responsibility of the doctor. And this is the way that it was in the past, as we just said, that doctors could not do this because of the Hippocratic Oath. But we did have what was called the pater familias.
If I can just interject there, I think as far as doctors are concerned, the word poison covers a multitude of things. If you drink some things in excess, then they become poisonous. So, for example, if you drink alcohol in excess, that becomes a poison. If you take most medicines in excess, and you know every bottle of pills usually has a little notice on it saying do not exceed the stated dose. Because if you exceed the stated dose, then that particular medication can become poisonous. And so doctors do quite routinely give patients pills to take that if they took them in all in one go would actually be lethal to them. And so I think as far as the Hippocratic Oath is concerned, I can see why people have interpreted it over the decades and the centuries in the way that they have. But I don't think the word poison, when the Hippocratic Oath was devised by Hippocrates, carries the same thing. I think he was thinking there of a doctor administering something which everybody knows is a poison in all circumstances, and where if you take that particular substance, it's likely to kill you irrespective of anything else. Whereas where there are other substances that you could ingest that would eventually be poisonous if you ingested sufficient quantities of them, they don't really qualify as poison.
Yeah, it's all to do with the quantity of them, isn't it? And I think the doctors expect you to take the recommended dose rather than to take them all together. So I think that's how they get around it, because all medicines are poisons, I should imagine, if taken in a sufficient quantity. Well, the pater familias is the title which means father of the family and also leader of the family. However, not every father was the leader of the family, for every male slave within the household was subject to the pater familias and therefore not the leader. So if you were a slave, then you couldn't be a pater familias, but the pater familias, the leader of the family, was responsible for the well-being of the slaves rather than the slave father. And this is a widespread Indo-European concept that stretches beyond the Greeks and the Romans. The fellow writing this says he hopes to revive awareness of the role of the father among his wife, his progeny and society within his lifetime. The role of the pater familias within Greco-Roman society was not a light one, and the burden of choice which he must have borne was not easy but necessary. The pater familias was responsible for deciding whether his children lived or died immediately after birth, and it was a heavy burden to bear. The pater familias had to decide if his child was fit to live, and if the child was unfit, it was exposed to the elements and left to die or killed by the hand of the pater familias himself, whether the child was his own or was born by his slaves. Among the Greeks, Aristotle wrote in his book Politics, "As to exposing or rearing the child born, let there be a law that no deformed child shall be reared, but on the ground of number of children, If the regular customs hinder any of those born being exposed, there must be a limit fixed to the procreation of offspring. And if any people have a child as a result of intercourse, in contravention of these regulations, abortion must be practiced on it, the child. Aristotle, Politics, Part 16. Exposing a child deserves explanation. There are many ways in which a person could die, but exposure was a very prolonged and indirect method of death. In Indo-European cultures, it was taboo for a father to kill his son, or a family member to kill any other family member, for that matter. However, exposure was seen as the will of the gods. Exposure gave the child a chance at life. If the child was left alone, it would die in the elements or be killed by a wild beast. If the child, however, was found by those who took pity upon it, it was said that the gods had taken pity upon the child themselves and they were saved. Often these children were picked up by barren women or by those who ran religious orphanages. So this was the system, this was the law, that no deformed child should be reared. And at the same time, that comes up against the law that you're not allowed to kill your any family members. So they would just expose a child to the elements. I mean, it seems very, very savage. But what was the other option? If that didn't happen, then you had these deformities and these congenital defects that were going to get introduced into the population. And you also had somebody that had to be looked after, which would be a burden upon the society. And as I say, it would weaken the society. Any thoughts on this, Max, or this concept of the paterfamilias?
I agree with what you've been saying. I think that the danger here is to assume that this sort of thing was happening sort of every other day, every other week, that there were, you know, babies being taken out and exposed on the mountaintops or whatever, these would have been fairly rare occurrences. And they would have been rare occurrences because they because of the fact that the practice existed. So once the practice existed, anybody that carried a deformity that would then manifest in their child would their child would have been exposed, and so therefore the genes that caused that deformity of whatever it was wouldn't have been passed on into the next generation, and so therefore it would have become very rare that this sort of thing actually had to happen. And so, you know, thankfully it wouldn't be a pleasant task. I can see why, even though you may accept from a logical perspective that the paterfamilias should expose the child or kill the child, from an emotional perspective, it would be quite a difficult thing to reconcile with. I guess exposure on the mountainside was regarded as the lesser of two evils in that respect. It enabled you, if you had a belief in gods that are looking down upon you, it would be that you could excuse the fact that you had subjected an unfortunate child to a prolonged and horrible death. It would have been a prolonged and horrible death nonetheless. But as I say, it probably wouldn't have happened as often as we might imagine.
That's a really good point to make. I think that, it wouldn't have happened because they had this process in law. If anybody was born like that, then they wouldn't have made it to adulthood in order to pass those genes on. So the very fact they actually had this law would have meant that they didn't have any disabled people, apart from people that have been disabled during battle. But they would have had nobody that introduced congenital defects into the population because that they actually had this. And this idea of the paterfamilias, I mean, it's a lot of responsibility there that is placed on the head of the family. And nowadays we're seeing more and more responsibility is taken away from the parents and taken over by the state. But back then, in this part of our development, there was far more responsibility was actually held by the father. Supported by the much later Greek writer Plutarch, this quote shows the brutal nature of ancient life. And he says, "Nor was it in the power of the father to dispose of the child as he saw fit, as was his right in most heathen societies. He was obliged to carry the newborn child before certain men at a place called Leshe. These men were some of the elders of the tribe to which the child belonged, and their business was to carefully view the infant, and if they found it stout and well made, they gave order for its rearing and allotted to it one of the 9,000 shares of land mentioned for its maintenance. But if they found it puny and ill-shaped, they ordered it to be taken to what was called the apothetae, the depository, a large cave under Mount Taygetus in the Peloponnese, as thinking it neither for the good of the child itself nor for the public interest that it should be brought up, if it did not from the very outset appear to be healthy and vigorous. And that is Plutarch in Lycurgus 16 talking about Sparta. And he also says, heavy was the weight of choice for the father to decide to kill his own children or the children of his slaves for the good of the public interest according to the strength of his people. Yet it has always been a heavy crown to bear. And I think this forms a part of the movie 300, which is about the Spartans. I think at the beginning they hold up a child, and that's what's going on here. So in this instance, the responsibility is actually taken away from the father and is taken on by the state, and they observe the child and they decide whether the child is fit. If the child is fit, then he gets brought up, and he also gets a bit of land that is allotted to him. And if he was unfit, then obviously other people have got to work their bits of land in order to pay for this child or to provide the resources for this child to be brought up. And then once the child is brought up, it's just going to create more. So it's just introducing weakness. So I think this is possibly a better way of doing it, because it puts the responsibility on the state. I guess this shows that they understood that it wasn't just all about the individual. It was about the group and about the way that your actions are going to affect the group. And the group takes precedence because the individual cannot survive without the group. And, you know, that is really quite stark here, isn't it? Because without the group, you know, a child that is exposed is not going to survive. So it's the good of the group that comes before the good of the individual. Any thoughts on these quotes, Max?
Yes, I think it is a matter of looking at the good of a group, and I think that children nowadays, to a great extent, are brought up to think of themselves as individuals and to think always individually. Is something good? How does it expect? How does it? Or is it bad? How does it affect me as an individual? That's the way the thinking goes. Whereas societies where they had to exist in a hostile environment, where there would be a lack of natural resources, or where there would be perhaps hostile tribes living around them, or hostile nations who might try to attack them and take their land, you know, they had to be as strong as possible, and the strength of the individual was measured in the contribution that the individual made to the clan or the nation or whatever, and so that was something that was very important, and people probably would have thought more collectively in those days than people tend to today.
Yes, and the Romans were no less brutal in the way they shaped society. During the early era of the Roman Republic, the many laws and customs of the people were codified into stone for all to see in 449 BC in what was called the Lex Tabularum, or as we know them, the 12 Tables. In the laws which deals with paternal powers, it was codified as follows. A notably deformed child shall be killed immediately. Table 4 of the 12 Tables of Roman Law. This connection between Roman laws and Greek laws makes sense if one understands that Greeks had a deep influence on the Romans, as much of the southern Italian peninsula was colonized by the Greeks and trade between the two was frequent. Seneca, the Roman statesman, wrote in his book on anger a passage about what a father would do to kill his child if he was stricken with grief and anger, instead of allowing the will of the gods to decide if a child lived or died. And he said, mad dogs we knock on the head, unnatural progeny we destroy, we drown even children at birth who are weakly and abnormal. And that's Seneca writing on anger, book 1, paragraph 15. This is quite clearly different from the method of allowing a child to die to the elements. But as was said earlier, the method of eugenics may differ, but the outcome is ultimately the same. The health of the society is protected. Ultimately, Valentinian outlawed the exposure of children in 374 AD in the Roman Empire. But those who continued the practice of eugenics were rarely, if ever, prosecuted for such acts. However, the practice did eventually die out shortly thereafter. So this was a part of our society many years ago, and we took it out. And I think it's because we took it out that we ended up with this increase in congenital deformities. And that then got increased at the time of the advancement of medical science about 200 years ago. And now we have lots of weak and sickly people, lots of disabled people. And I'm not suggesting that we should reinstate this and that, you know, deformed babies should be exposed to the elements. But we do have the ability to do genetic screening now. People can get genetically screened, find out if they have these weaknesses. And, you know, then they can take a decision that maybe it's not such a good idea to procreate. And people have procreated, if they have a scan and they discover that the child is going to have a deformity or is not going to be quite right, then, you know, really they should think about how this is going to affect society. And if we were all taught to identify not as individuals, but to identify as part of the group, then obviously somebody that did find out that they were carrying a disabled child, then they probably would decide to terminate the child rather than bring it up and have this burden on the group. But I think because today everybody is taught to be individuals, I think some people will find out that the child is not going to be quite right, and they will choose to continue to have the child anyway, which does create the burden on to the group itself and runs the risk of reintroducing that weakness into the group. That's the thing, isn't it? So this was a part of our society. We wanted to prevent this. We knew that the good of the group came before the good of the individual, but I guess we just got squeamish about doing it. It is a brutal yet necessary topic to discuss, the topic of eugenics, but it would not be forbidden knowledge if it did not dismay some of our listeners by diving into the topic. We live in a society protected by civilization. Modern medicine can remedy many ailments in today's living, but a remedy is not a cure, and many diseases cannot be cured or deformities fixed. Since the dangers of the wild no longer cull the sick and the deformed to protect the genetic health of a people, some decision must be taken for the good of the people. In modern times, death is not the only means of preventing bad genetics from being passed down, and not all deformities and diseases can be prevented once and for all by mere eradication. I would refer to the killing of those with poor genetics or incurable diseases as hard eugenics. An easier and more manageable system of eugenics would be to encourage, educate, and incentivize those who are stricken by ill birth to not procreate. The methods of eugenics are divergent, but the outcome is the same. Be the practices heavy-handed or soft-handed, the overall problem of the accumulation of dysgenic genes within a modern civilization must be addressed. And that was really what Sir Francis Galton and the others 120 years ago were trying to prevent. They could foresee that there would be more and more weaker people that would be born into the nation, and that would just generally bring down the standards of the group, of the ethnicity. But it was done away with at the end of the Second World War, and, you know, we really don't have any other way to prevent this. And so we just end up with lots and lots of disabled people, lots of mentally disabled people, and they all need looking after. And really all we should have to do is to tell people that you know, if they have genetic problems, it's not a good idea to breed, and it's just going to be a burden on society. As I say, we have modern ways that we can deal with this now. We have ways due to screening and what have you. But it's not really talked about in the way that it should be, I think. And eugenics are looked upon as being a negative thing because of the Second World War. And obviously, euthanasia in this way that it's been talked about here, that's frowned upon. And instead of having positive eugenics, what we have is dysgenics. We have the encouraging of dysgenic genes, and we have the idea of people having assisted suicide just because they get depressed in their 20s in some instances. It's like the reversal of the way that things should be. And also, I think because of this, because they implemented this, this is one of the reasons why when you look at these Greek statues and Roman statues, they're all perfect people. You don't see any representations of disabled, because they didn't have any disabled back then, purely and simply because they had this law. Any final thoughts on that, Max?
Well, really just that it's the... I don't think we necessarily need to focus too much on the danger of there being lots and lots of disabled people. Although, you know, I think that if you don't have some way of screening out the disadvantageous genes, then it will increase the proportion of disabled people within a society. The most important element of it, though, is not the numbers of disabled people, but the lack of exceptional people. And this is something that positive eugenics, encouraging people who've got exceptional qualities to have children at a rate which is in excess of the replacement rate, that's where the benefits of eugenics will be really felt. And what we need to do is to have a program where children are not just taught that it's the right thing to do to limit their fecundity if they've got unattractive characteristics or unhelpful characteristics, but where there are children who've got exceptional characteristics, exceptional abilities, that they should be encouraged to have more children, so that the proportion of people with those exceptional characteristics increases in society with each passing generation.
Yeah, we certainly need to get more and more geniuses born, and more people that are exceptional, and we do seem to be having a decreasing number of them. And again, that's I think a lot of that is to do with immigration, and we have this average IQ of the nation is gradually being lowered. But we've got one final bit to talk about with eugenics, which we'll bring up in the next episode, I think. So thank you very much for coming on today, Max.
That's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.